Are we ready?
That means yes. Secretary's ready. It's 8:45. Now, bang my gavel. I love to do that. And call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission for Thursday, September the 8th to order. Madam Secretary, could you call a roll, please?
Commissioner Gibson?
Here.
Commissioner Christie?
Here.
Commissioner Malskow?
Here.
Commissioner Rappa?
Here.
And Chairman Rose?
Here. And I'll ask that we all please stand for a flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Now is the time for public comment. This is the opportunity for people to come and address the commission on items that are not on today's agenda. Today's agenda is available at the back of the room, that little wooden container in the back, along with speaker slips. And I have two people for public comment, Cheryl Flores. And you get 3 minutes, and let's see, we got timers, and they turn green until you have 1 minute, and then it turns yellow, and then it turns red at 3 minutes, and out comes the hook.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. My name is Cheryl Flores. I'm from People's Self-Help Housing, and I thought as you're considering the North Coast area plan, it would be a good time to come in and remind you about the struggles of affordable housing and what People's Self-Help and Habitat for Humanities are trying to do to mitigate the struggles. People's Self-Help Housing has been in the county for 35 years. We started here at the request of other local governments. We spread into Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. Last year, we completed our 1,000th home. We've been building, working with families to build self-help houses. We've completed 1,000 homes. We also own and manage 1,200 apartments in the area. We've developed units in almost every community in San Luis Obispo County. We serve a very diverse clientele, working families, seniors, farm workers, and special needs households, including those that are transitioning out of shelters and persons with disabilities. We serve a diverse range of incomes. Our home ownership program tends to serve families earning between 35 to 80% of median income. Half of the families we serve are below 50% of median income. Our rental housing program serves families between 30 and 60% of area median income. And our rental housing communities generally incorporate common facilities so that we can provide other services aimed at improving the quality of life of our residents, such as education programs, health clinics, and things like that. In the county today, some projects that we're working on or have just completed. In San Miguel, we just completed 46 sweat equity homes for first-time home buyers. Earlier this year in Paso Robles, we completed 29 senior-style apartments, and across the street from that, we're working on 68 multifamily units called Canyon. Facing will land is the biggest constraint. There's an inadequate supply of vacant land with residential zoning, and market-rate developers have snapped up everything that's available. So because we have such a finite supply of vacant land, we need to strongly encourage developers to and offer them incentives so that they will develop affordable housing and possibly work with People's Self-Help and Habitat. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Flores? I had one. I've heard that the stopper is land costs. Could you come out with a generalization for what if you was to buy a lot, how much does that cost market rate? I understand it varies throughout the county, but it's some ballpark figure.
We can't even find a single-family lot available anywhere. Since I've been with the company 10 years, I've developed 50 single-family homes a year. We've now come to a dead halt, except for the 8 coming into Pomo, because I can't buy single-family zoned land, period. It's not even available.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to make one comment, Chairman Rose. And I want to thank you, Ms. Flores, for coming down here today. I know we deal with a lot of issues that affect affordable housing, and it's really important to engage in the planning process. You mentioned at the beginning of your testimony that it was sort of our review of the North Coast Area Plan that had sparked you to come down here today.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I'd love to get your card if you can pass that up.
Sure.
But number two, I would really encourage you, if you have the time, I know you're probably extremely busy and understaffed, but if you do have the time to actually take a look at the plan itself and any recommended policy changes, language changes, program suggestions, we're past chapter two, which dealt with housing, but we're still mm-hmm. reviewing the entire plan, and if you have some suggestions that could help provide more affordable housing in Cambria and San Simeon, I think this commission would be very interested to consider your recommendations. So if you have time to do that, we'll
try to make the time we intended to look at it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll pass my card up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker, Mary Van Aken.
Ms. Forbes.
Whoops.
Good morning. My name is Mary Van Aken, and I'm representing Habitat for Humanity for San Luis Obispo County. Habitat for Humanity for San Luis Obispo County is an affiliate for Habitat Humanity International, established in 1997. Our mission is to eliminate poverty housing. We have built three homes for very low-income families in Paso Robles. We are building one home in Cambria now. It will be finished later this year. We have two more homes to build in Cambria. We will start building them in the second half of 2006. Habitat families earned between 25 and 50% of the median income for the county. This is between $15,425 and $30,854 a family of four. They qualify as very low income family under the HUD guidelines. The obstacles we face are Habitat lacks property to build on. High land costs make it nearly impossible for Habitat to acquire land. We rely on donated property and property acquired through CDBG funds. Building fees add to the cost of constructions. Water retrofit and connection fees alone for our current Cambria property came to over $9,000. The permitting process is confusing when dealing with both county planning and building and the Cambria CSD. This process takes too long. Approval of building permit can take 8 to 10 months. It is difficult for families living in inadequate and often substandard housing to wait for better housing. The situation with property tax for deed-restricted properties is unclear. We do not know if Habitat homes will be assessed at market value or at a value of construction at the time of construction. Property taxes at market value would be a great burden for our low-income families. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Again, thank you very much for coming down, Mrs. Valakam. These are important issues, and we need to be reminded of them, I think, on a regular basis. You mentioned the cost of the building fees.
Yes.
This commission routinely, when we approve development, have a standard condition for affordable housing fees to go into a fund that offsets the cost of the building fees. I understand the water retrofit fees in Cambria are a different issue, but I think we'd be interested to hear if you could speak to that. Are those fees did? That means that it does not appreciate in value at the same rate that the market appreciates in value. It basically, because it's subsidized housing, it has a cap on how quickly it can appreciate. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So I think that's a question probably for the assessor's
Assessor.
Office.
Yes.
And, that's a really good question, and I think we'd all like to know the answer to that
okay.
as well. Thank you again
okay.
for coming down
Thank
this
you.
Morning.
Thank you. Anyone else for public comment? I don't have any other speaker slips. Seeing none, I'll close the public comment and ask Mr. Orton the issue that Ms. Christie raised about public facility fees, I understand. Could you perhaps give us your explanation of how that works?
Well, my understanding of those fees are offset public facilities fees, not building permit fees, and I thought maybe she was talking about building permit fees.
Right, and which you got school fees, you got road fees, you got park fees, et cetera, and this, the public facility fees is one rather small portion of all that fee package. Would I be correct in this?
That's my understanding.
Mr. Chair, Dana Lilly's here, and as part of staff updates, he was going to address the issue of the public facility fees based on your questions from last time.
Okay.
So if we get into staff updates, after I take care of a couple of housekeeping things, he can speak to that, and the people that came up for public comment may want to wait for that discussion.
Okay, so we finished public comment, moving on to planning staff updates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Warren Hogue, Department of Planning and Building. The first thing I wanted to mention was we're looking for a date to hold the Planning Commission retreat, and we had given you these calendars, and we've got three of them back. We need to get two more back. I won't identify the individuals because you know who you are. But if I could, if I could get them, or John could get them, by the end of the day, that would be lovely. Thank you. Also, I wanted to update the entire commission that the first subcommittee meeting with Commissioners Melskow and Rapa on reviewing the Planning Commission's rules and procedures will be next Wednesday. And we've got that scheduled, and hopefully at a upcoming meeting after that or possibly at the retreat, the committee subcommittee will be ready to discuss their comments with the whole commission. So that's what I had for staff updates. Matt, anything on Coastal? Okay. Dana, would you like to address the public facility fee issue?
Thanks. Dana Lilly with your planning staff. I work in a small section called Housing and Economic Development, and pleased to see people from Habitat and People Self-Help Housing Corporation here today. I don't know everything about the Public Facilities Impact Fee Program, but hopefully I can answer most of your questions today, and it has been a source of ongoing confusion for a lot of people. I wanted to give a little bit of background, though, before getting right to answers. When the county, working with a consultant, developed the Public Facilities Impact Fee Program, we started by calculating the anticipated cost of a number of public facilities and came up with a dollar amount. We also forecasted how much would it cost per housing unit to finance those things, and calculated an impact fee. That's the public facilities impact fee, an oversimplification, but basically that's how we came up with it. Then the consultant and our staff discussed the problems of affordable housing and concluded that, gee, a several thousand dollar impact fee on affordable housing is a problem. What are we going to do about that? The advice of that expert consultant, and we're still reviewing whether this is still true or not, was that impact fees cannot be adjusted based on ability to pay. We can't simply waive it or reduce it for affordable housing for impact fees. And apparently it's a legal issue, but like I said, we're going to look into that for the future. So if you'll notice, in the Public Facilities Impact Fee Ordinance, where there's a list of exemptions up front, it doesn't include affordable housing. So as you read this ordinance, it sort of appears that it applies to affordable housing. You get further into the ordinance, you find we added another fee on market rate lots that we call the affordable housing in lieu fee that is intended to fill through the in lieu fee to cover the amount of fees we've waived. And we may have to adjust it in the future. But I do want to make it really clear, the affordable housing in lieu fee in practice is not collected in lieu of a developer building required affordable housing. So it that's partly why it's misleading. Another part of that's misleading is we don't collect that fee to fund construction of affordable housing. It's really just collected to compensate the county for not collecting the public facilities in fee from affordable housing. Every quarter, as I understand it, any fees that have accumulated through that in lieu fee are transferred into the different accounts for the different types of public facilities. They are not held and transferred when an affordable housing development comes to us. Similarly, when People's Self-Help Housing Corporation applies or when Habitat applies to the county, those fees are not available to pay hookup charges to community services districts or county service areas, building permit fees, any of those assorted fees. Unfortunately, that help cannot come from that source for that problem. Hopefully, I'm answering parts of your questions here. The county has proposed an inclusionary housing program. And when adopted, it may include an option for developers who are faced with a requirement that they build affordable housing. There may be an option for them to pay a fee in lieu of building it. That depends on whether your commission agrees with that, and ultimately the Board of Supervisors agrees with that. If that happens, we will have to change something in the public facilities fee accordingly, because we can't have two affordable housing in lieu fees. And if the commission would like, I can endeavor to answer the question that Habitat posed about their taxes, if it's okay.
That would be nice.
Sure, thanks. I shouldn't speak for the tax assessor, but I was in a meeting with them on this issue because the county's land use ordinance and coastal zone land use ordinance have a mechanism for assuring long-term affordability. And it's not exactly the same thing as a deed restriction. It acts like a loan, but the assessor, with help of their legal advice, have concluded that it does affect market value somewhat. It's not the same as limiting the price exactly to our affordable housing standard, but they do believe it reduces market value somewhat. Under state law, as I understand it, the assessor is required to assess for tax purposes that property based on fair market value. So the units that Habitat builds, if they are restricted the way our ordinance says they should be restricted, will be taxed at a value slightly below market value, but it will still be quite a bit. We are proposing to change how our long-term affordability works and in the future, but that is not what is subject to what their homes are subject to now. I'm also available to answer questions.
Any questions for Mr. Lilly?
I have at least one here. Today, when you started talking about the ordinance, you said that you can't charge different fees based on ability to pay. But I wasn't quite certain. Did you indicate that affordable housing is exempted from the fee rather than having it adjusted?
No. It's not exempted, but we are collecting the in-lieu fee with the intent of paying the county back and therefore not charging affordable housing. I agree it's confusing to me, too, as I read the ordinance, but in practice, it's the same net effect of us waiving the public facilities fee for affordable housing.
So there's some difference between waiving the fee, because you are blanket waiving the fee on at least certain levels of
officially, I have to advise you that we are not waiving the public facilities fee. We are paying it on behalf of affordable housing, just not on a project-by-project basis. We are paying it on behalf of affordable housing quarterly.
Okay.
and not tied to specific projects.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is
housing. You're talking about low and very low?
Yes.
Just those two categories?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Lilly, the way I understand it is we're collecting fees from market rate development as it goes forward, and we're using those fees to essentially, the county, are using those fees to essentially pay ourselves the public facilities fees that we aren't charging for the affordable units. Would that be
yes.
accurate way? Okay. But that only relates to the public facilities fees. It doesn't relate to things like building fees and other fees that the county pays. Is there any way that that program could be expanded so that we could use those fees to pay ourselves for not charging building fees, for instance, for affordable units, building permit fees?
I think it may be possible. It's not, I don't think, covered by the existing ordinance. So I don't think our department would have authority to do that right now. Also, as I said earlier, the amount of this so-called in lieu fee we're collecting is less
inadequate
than we're losing by not charging affordable housing. So that would be an additional shortfall.
To raise that fee, would that require an ordinance amendment, or is that something that could be done internally within the department?
That would be an ordinance amendment.
Okay. So along with that ordinance amendment, there's no other statewide statutory impediment, maybe this is a question to County Council, that would prevent us from expanding the types of permits that could be covered by that fee if it were increased to the extent that it could cover those costs, like building fees?
Well, I think that fees part of the public facilities fees program, which is governed by state law, and I think it's based upon studies that we prepared. And if we were going to raise that fee to use it for other purposes, I think there need to be studies that would support that. I had also indicate that the issue of fees, the board sets building permit fees and other fees by ordinance every year, and always has the authority to waive fees on a case-by-case basis.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I believe that as County Council has indicated, and actually the planning director can waive certain building-related fees up to a certain amount. I forget the amount. And then beyond that amount, it goes to the Board of Supervisors, and in fact, I know the Board of Supervisors has waived some building-related fees for affordable housing. So there is a mechanism in place for some of the, quote, other costs, the planning costs.
I guess one question I had, you'd indicated that your department's working on an inclusionary housing ordinance in implementing policy. Is there explicit consideration of the fee structure and using what fees might be collected under that ordinance to waive or at least cover the fees that otherwise would be put on affordable projects?
If I understand your question, I say the answer is yes.
Okay.
We do need to look at the implications for inclusionary housing and in lieu fees that might be charged for that to other fees we charge.
You had also mentioned you wanted to make the distinction between the in-lieu fee that we charge and what that goes for as compared to an in-lieu fee that's paid in lieu of providing required affordable units was the language that you used. And at this point, we don't have an inclusionary housing ordinance, but we have a lot of projects that come forward that could include inclusionary housing as a permit, as a condition of the permit. Can you maybe talk to us for a moment about the circumstances under which we could do that and how we might start building that into projects at the planning stage so that it comes to the Planning Commission with affordable components in it in this interim time before we have our inclusionary housing ordinance in place?
There are two different avenues to accomplish what you've suggested. One is And we're working on this with County Council, is to prepare and publish a notice that puts basically all applicants on notice that the county has proposed an inclusionary housing program. And if they file their application after the date of this notice, but their development is not approved prior to adoption of the inclusionary housing ordinance, then it will apply. Unless we publish that notice, it won't apply to
of housing types and locate employee housing adjacent to where the work is happening, and there we have a variety of policies. Can't we require inclusionary units, simply making the findings of general plan conformity with those policies in our adopted housing element? Couldn't those be used as findings to justify the units?
I'll speak from just a policy point of view first. The housing element does not say that specifically that it's the Board of Supervisors' intent that the county will require inclusionary housing prior to an ordinance being adopted. There is a program that says we'll prepare an inclusionary housing ordinance, so it sort of leaves open whether the county will, in fact, adopt it. I don't know. But we do have direction via the housing element that we will prepare a draft ordinance. So if you read the policies in the housing element, they don't specifically say we need to start doing that right away. It does say that the county, you know, will provide for housing for all income groups, but it doesn't get specifically to the point of inclusionary housing.
But so my understanding is when we have an inclusionary housing ordinance, it won't be optional. It will be a requirement that has to be met. Every project that comes through that meets those has to meet those standards. It won't be a question anymore. Mm-hmm. But until we have that, we have the discretion. We don't need specific language in the housing element that tells us we can require inclusionary units in advance of having an ordinance. It's discretionary. We can do it project by project. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because what I'm hearing is that to make the case-by-case argument that every individual project will have a certain impact on affordable housing and what that impact will be and, you know, how that all works, you know, in terms of the nexus and the findings, that's a lot of work, and that's difficult to do, and it requires a lot of staff time. So it's probably not going to happen. What I'm saying is, rather than going through all that rigmarole, why can't we just make the findings to require inclusionary units on projects where it makes sense? I'm not saying every single project, but on project where it makes sense, and simply make the findings of general plan conformity with our adopted policies of Chapter 4 of the housing element. I mean, I guess that's a rhetorical question. Maybe staff can kick it around. You know, I don't want to get into a big debate here. We got a long agenda ahead of us. But I'm just putting that out there as maybe a possible avenue that we haven't traveled down far enough, and maybe it would be a good path to follow. So it's just a suggestion.
Thank you.
And with that, this could be an all-day topic.
It could be, and probably should be.
And probably will be.
Probably should
be. But not today. It's not on today's agenda. So unless there's any other further comments, then go.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly, for that.
Conclude that. Anything else for staff updates? Seeing none, move on to the consent agenda, which was minutes for the June 23rd, July 14th meeting.
Unless, Mr. Chairman, there are additions or corrections, I would move approval of the consent agenda.
I'll second.
And I will abstain, not having been a member of this august body at the time those minutes were generated.
Okay. I'm going to presume there. I have to ask for public comment. Anybody else want to comment on our minutes? I didn't think so. Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. So it's four with one abstention. Could you introduce our first hearing item, please? And again, the agendas are available back in the wooden box towards the left on the way out.
Hearing number one is a hearing to consider a request by Richard Kelly and TEC Engineering for a vesting tentative tract map, tract 2663, to subdivide an existing one-acre parcel into five parcels. Project includes off-site road improvements to Theodora Street and Buckhorn Lane, residential land use category, South County Inland Planning Area, County File Number SUB 2004-00215, Tract 2663, Supervisorial District 4, Stephanie Fuse, Project Manager.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the Commission, Stephanie Fuse, County Planning. As was just stated, this project is a tract to subdivide an approximately one-acre parcel into five parcels, ranging in size from 6,400 square feet to 14,200 square feet. The project is located on Buckhorn Lane in the community of Napomo. The project is located in the residential single family for the life of the CCNRs.
Okay.
After turf areas.
So 22G, which now reads, prior to issuance of construction permits, the applicant shall provide landscape and irrigation plans showing the following measures for turf areas. And then it goes on to list three. What are we going to do there?
And add, and for the life of the CCNRs.
I think that's the same issue we came up against last.
Well, I understand perfectly. I'm just, I like to have a, I'm trying to figure out where it goes. I like a piece of paper in front of me. And
I had it, didn't bring it. Sorry.
Bad move.
So how will the sentence read?
Prior to issuance of construction permits, the applicant shall provide landscape and irrigation plans showing the following measures for turf areas, comma, and for the life of the CCNRs.
And that goes for 22G and 23E. One being the additional map sheet, the second one was for the CCNRs. Okay. That gets rid of my little sticky. Questions for staff?
Mr. Chairman, do we have a map? I had a hard time telling exactly where the private easements were in the driveways, the map that was included. Maybe it's just my...
No, it wasn't used because I had the same thing. It says show driveway better in my little...
Yeah, I had a very difficult time on seeing exactly where it would be.
Yeah. Perhaps if the clerk can put the PowerPoint back up.
You got to be on the mic there, Ms. Griffin. Okay, and this is what we have on page 141.
41.
The driveway goes down the middle.
Okay.
But I believe then there were also two lots that didn't take access from this driveway. Did I read that correctly?
Right, lots 4 and 5 would take access off of Buckhorn Road.
Just as individual driveways.
And just for the record, I have, on my page 141, I have two lot fours. I'm glad you've explained it. You show up here the lot that is the smaller lot, the 9,262-square-foot lot, is, in fact, lot five.
That's right. Yeah. Noticed that yesterday.
And then as a follow-up question, if lots two, I assume it's, 1, 2, and 5 are those which will use the driveway and the easement?
1, 2, and 3.
1, 2, and 3.
Will lots 4 and 5 be required to help maintain? Because it talks about the CCNRs incorporating the requirement for maintenance through the CCNRs, of which are all lots participants?
All lots are participants, but the CCNRs could be written so that the maintenance requirement only falls on lot 1, 2, and 3. It's up to them. All we care about is that it gets maintained.
Wait a minute. Why wouldn't lot 4 be part of this? Where's lot 4 get access from?
Buckhorn.
Okay.
Can I go back to your 22G and 23E? Just a very minor word change that I has been bothering me here. It says, prior to issuance of construction permits, the applicant shall provide landscape and irrigation plans showing the following measures for turf areas and for the life of the CCNRs. The fact is, we want the turf areas to be maintained according to these requirements for the life of the CCNRs. So instead of the word and, I think maybe we just say the following measures for turf areas to be maintained for the life of the CCNRs. Otherwise, they just have to have plans on hand, and they could do whatever they want.
I like that better. Does anyone else agree?
Oh, I agree. Maybe we could sort of incorporate that into standard language since it's come up several times.
Right.
Now the next one.
Okay. So we've modified it yet again.
Okay. That goes in both places?
Yes.
Right. 22G, 23E.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions for staff?
Yes? I had a question on page 118 under the biological resources. The staff report mentions that the project site is located within an area designated as critical habitat for the vernal pool fairy shrimp, which is a federally listed endangered species. And it says that the staff conducted a site visit and found that the site is predominantly non-native grasses and ornamental landscaping.
Negative declaration. I was looking on page 122 and 123 under public services. I didn't see any check marks whether this is a significant impact or not for 10E or F, which is solid waste and other facilities. Can I assume that there was insignificant impact?
That's right. Those boxes just were inadvertently missed.
So we'll put check marks under insignificant impacts for 10E and 10F. More questions? Seeing none, open the public hearing. Is the applicant here? Wish to make a presentation?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Bill Dyer. I'm with Tech Engineering. I'm representing the developer. And we have reviewed the conditions, and we have no objections to any of the conditions. And I'm here to answer any questions that you might have.
And you heard the little change we made, but...
Right, those were fine.
Okay. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I have no speaker slips. Anyone from the public wish to address the Commission on this matter? You need to come up, and you also need to give us a speaker slip so we make sure we get your name. But in the interest of brevity, come up now. Come up to the other microphone, and when this gentleman completes...
Could I get a speaker slip, please?
You could... Could you get to the microphone, please, Mr. Lowry?
Yeah, I'd like to speak. I'd like to get a speaker slip.
Okay. The speaker slips are in the back of the room in a little wooden box there right underneath the agenda. After you speak, could you fill one out and hand it to the secretary so she gets your name spelled right? So in the meantime, give your name and your place of residence.
James Lowry, and I live in Oceano.
Okay.
Do you need an address?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking over the agenda here, and I see subdivision, recommendation, approval.
No, wait a minute. We're talking just about one particular tentative tract map.
In particular, I see... tentative tract map 2663, recommend approval. I recommend disapproval. I've been here 22 years in the county, and all I've seen is rampant development. And this is obviously an example of that. If you want more pollution, traffic, I mean, when I moved here, it was a great place to live. You keep doing this stuff like this, the place is going to get trashed. That's all I can say. You're going to have overcrowding. It's going to be just like where I moved from Montebello down in L.A. This is too much.
Okay.
That's all I've got to say.
Thank
I'll
you.
Fill out the slip. Thank you.
Appreciate that. And the next speaker?
Ruth Lester.
Oh, you got to get to the microphone so we get you on tape and all that stuff.
I'm sorry. I'm Ruth Lester. I live on Tanis in Napomo, which is directly adjacent to this property we're now discussing. I have no objection to the development as it's laid out. I have only an objection, and I don't know if this is the place to voice it, Mr. Ruse.
It would be.
We had, when we built the house 7 years ago, moved in 5 years ago, 180-degree view from our property. This property is directly behind us. At this point, to our right, that development has already been built, and they brought in soil, raised the elevation of the land, eliminated one-third of our view. My objection at this point, and the only reason I raise it, is because of that little tiny note down at the bottom. If you don't raise it at this meeting, you may not be able to raise it later. When this development is planned and built, I would like the elevation of the land, I would like, everybody on our block would like, the elevation of the land to remain the same, not have the soil brought in and this the slot number two raised to the point where we lose that total view as well. We lose the value of our home. We lose our view. We lose our comfort in our home. That's my only objection at this point.
Thank you kindly.
Thank you.
And if you'd be so kind as to get one of them speaker slips and hand it to the secretary so she'll get your name right. Anyone else from the public wish to speak to this matter? And the applicant's agent can make some concluding remarks or rebuttals. And I do have a question for you. So. Yeah, come on up. And the question would be related to the last speakers. What are your plans as far as are you going to bring in some more dirt? Or?
Mr. Chairman, the grade of the lot basically falls from the...
your name, please.
Bill Dyer with Tech Engineering. Basically falls from the rear, as you face it from the street, it rises up from the street.
Which street? The Buckhorn Road or Theodore Street?
Probably need to look at the diagram here.
Maybe the staff could.
On 141.
Or public view shed?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Cammie Griffin, County Planning staff. The responsibility is to look at public view shed views from public roads, and we don't evaluate private and protect private views.
Okay, so we couldn't put a condition on here saying don't block Mr. and Mrs. Smith's view.
If your commission felt that that was something you wanted to do, you could do that, but that's not something that typically will get evaluated.
Okay. Any other questions for staff?
I've got a concern about the the vernal pools. I got an email from Sierra Club yesterday alerting me to this issue. He indicated that it had been sent to the planning department as well, but it may not have gotten through the system yet. But I think we have a problem in that this site, I don't have a problem with the development as it's proposed. I'm not concerned with that, but I am concerned about making the required findings under CEQA that there are going to be insignificant impacts to biological resources. And I'm concerned about that because if this project is in an area that has been designated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as critical habitat for vernal pool fairy shrimp, and we haven't done a Section 7 consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, whose charge it is to oversee the implementation of the Endangered Species Act. And we don't have a biologist on site. I mean, with all due respect to planning staff, I know they're very familiar with these issues, but vernal pools are very specific and complicated habitats. And I noodled around on the internet yesterday and went to vernalpools.org, which provides lots of great links. And the page that I printed out was actually from the EPA website. And what I learned about vernal pools is that they're very ephemeral. They fill with water for very short periods of time throughout the year. I'll quote very briefly that the pools collect water during winter and spring rains, changing in volume in response to varying weather patterns. during a single season, pools may fill and dry several times. So a site visit, you know, one site visit one day in December to determine that there aren't vernal pools present, I don't think meets the test. There are some very specific soil tests that need to be looked at. Vernal pools have a hard clay pan underneath the surface that causes them to hold the water. And they can occur in sites that appear level, that on a broad sense appear to be flat landscape, but on a micro level actually have a lot of variation in them. As stated, that they're often smaller than the bulldozer that threatens to destroy them. So we have three projects before us today that are all in this same area, and I'm going to bring these issues up on every item because I think that we cannot, I don't think we've crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's here. I don't think we can go forward and approve development in federally listed critical habitat for vernal pool fairy shrimp based on a non-biologist determination on a single site visit that there wasn't any standing water on the site. That's not how you determine the presence of vernal pools. And as we know, if there are vernal pools present, we're going to have to do something entirely different. I mean, if anybody followed the conversations about UC Merced, the vernal pools essentially resited the entire campus. And so I'm going to propose that because we can't make the necessary findings under CEQA and under the Endangered Species Act, that we continue this item until we have more complete biological information.
I would ask planning if they could outline exactly what they had done in terms of assessing the site and whether anyone from Environmental Division had looked at it. Maybe it's probably not a Section 7 consultation, but there seems to be a consultation here. So.
You're up. She's busy. She's ignoring you.
We have Julie Eliason, who is our staff biologist, who generally helps us when we have issues such as this. So
okay, we're going to force her to the microphone then.
Pools to occur on the site or not. And if there is, then we would recommend that a biologist do a vernal pool assessment. However, if the topography is such that it wouldn't lend itself to vernal pools, the planner could at that time make a determination that a vernal pool assessment by a qualified biologist is not necessary.
Okay. Now, in terms of assessing critical habitat, has that protocol been vetted with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
We have had some contact with the Fish and Wildlife Service, but there's no specific protocol on determining the likelihood of vernal pools being there. If vernal pools do occur on the site, then there is an established protocol for doing assessments as to determining impacts on the potential resource.
A U.S. Fish and Wildlife protocol for doing that?
Well, the Fish and Wildlife Service has a protocol for surveying for vernal pool fairy shrimp or other sensitive crustaceans that could occur in there. There's an established protocol for that. There's also a protocol established by the Army Corps of Engineers and also the Department of Fish and Game for determining whether a wetland, whether the site qualifies as wetland status. So they're kind of two different things. The Fish and Wildlife Service has jurisdiction over endangered species. The Army Corps and the Department of Fish and Game would have jurisdiction over wetlands and vernal pools.
All right, and I guess, is it not, in dealing with critical habitats, doesn't our Environmental Division often get involved in making the assessments as to, you know, I know from dealing with U.S. Fish and Wildlife that the question of unoccupied critical habitat is one that they wrestle with. But it does seem reasonable to me that if we are working in critical habitat that we get the right information?
The actual term critical habitat refers to endangered species critical habitats, and it's officially designated habitat by the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service for habitat that's critical to the survival of a listed species. So that is a special designation. If you're talking sensitive habitat that is not critical habitat, for example, a vernal pool may not be designated as critical habitat for an endangered species, but it may be considered sensitive habitat that needs to be analyzed for impacts.
Okay. But this particular site doesn't fall within a sensitive resource area according to county planning, right?
Because I'm not familiar with this particular project, having just walked in, I don't believe that site is within critical habitat for endangered species because it's in the South County, and the critical habitat areas that the Fish and Wildlife Service has designated for the vernal pool fairy shrimp, for example, is in other parts of the county.
Well, our staff report, I'll quote you from our staff report. The project site is located within the Santa Barbara vernal pool region. The project site is located within an area that has identified vernal pool habitats as determined by aerial survey mapping by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The project site is located within an area designated as critical habitat for the vernal pool fairy shrimp.
Okay.
So that's all we have to go on. And
because it is designated as critical habitat, that should have been looked at during the site visit to determine if the site lended itself to vernal pool habitat. If it was very hilly, steep terrain, that would not lend itself to vernal pool habitat, and therefore it'd be extremely unlikely that there would be habitat on site.
Okay, it's not hilly and steep. Okay. It's actually the opposite. Staff is saying this, and the other sites are flat, and therefore water wouldn't pool there. So, but flat land is where vernal pools occur, as we know.
Well, I'm looking at the topo on page 141, and it appears to slope, as the applicant stated, essentially from, I'll get this wrong here. Anyway, it slopes from lot 2, which appears to be the high point, as the applicant said, down to Buckhorn and Theodore Street. And
yeah.
This is your district. Are you driven by there, and what did you see?
Yes, it's a hill.
It's a hill.
I thought I saw that it was level to gently sloping. But level average slope is between 0 and 15%.
Yeah. Look at the topo lines on 141.
Mr. Chairman, there's a map up on the computer that shows the vernal pool regions.
Not
located within the Santa Barbara vernal pool region, and it's not in area that's designated as critical habitat.
It is within the Santa Barbara vernal pool region, but it is not within an area designated as critical habitat.
So what does it mean that it says it's within the Santa Barbara vernal pool region? As determined by who, and what level of regulatory responsibility comes with that designation?
Well, as I stated earlier, if it falls within one of those blue areas as a vernal pool region, it just draws attention to us to take a look at that issue.
Okay.
When we analyze the impacts on the project. And if we determine that there could be potential vernal pools on site, we would recommend that a biologist do a vernal pool assessment at that time.
Okay. Well, but it is not designated as critical habitat.
No.
Okay. That clears that up.
Okay. So then are we ready for some more discussion or motions? Or
you ready for a motion?
Well, first of all, I would move that we can amend the neg deck? Can we revise it?
Certainly
we
can.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we need to take that sentence out.
Okay.
I'll second that motion.
To take that sentence out. Could we just be a little more specific here? On page...
Page 118.
118.
We need to delete the sentence that reads, the project site is located within an area designated as critical habitat for the vernal pool fairy shrimp.
Okay. And I assume there's consensus for that.
I would offer one other amendment, if the motion maker agrees, and it's located within an area that has been identified as a vernal pool region, as determined by aerial survey mapping. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, it is. It's correct that it's within the vernal pool region, but not correct that it's either critical habitat or designated vernal pool habitat.
Okay.
Yeah, Motion maker agrees with that?
That sounds like we're moving to a greater degree of accuracy.
We have a consensus on that, and we're seeing five heads nodding yes. All right. Moving right on here.
Are we going to vote that motion? Or?
No, we're just taking it as consensus.
Ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion.
I would move to adopt the mitigated negative declaration in accordance with applicable provisions of CEQA as amended on biological resources, and number two, to approve vesting tract tentative tract 2663 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B as modified and read into the record 22G, 23B, and E.
And the negative declaration changes were the ones just discussed. We agreed to the vernal pool issue and the adding some check marks and where they were missing.
Correct. Yeah, those changes.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Roll call.
Commissioner Mouskow?
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Gibson?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
You know, I'm going to speak to the motion just very briefly. I'm not opposed to the project. I'm still uncomfortable with a single site visit at one day during the year without any soil analysis, coming to the conclusion that this is not definitively not vernal pool habitat. So I'm not going to be able to support the motion, and I'm voting no.
Chairman Rose?
Yes. Thank you. And our next item, would you introduce that, Madam Secretary, please?
Item 2 is a hearing to consider a request by Kathleen Benson for a vesting tentative tract map to subdivide an existing 1.2-acre parcel into five parcels of 10,000 square feet each for the purpose of sale and or development. The project includes off-site road improvements to Bloom and Grant Streets, residential single-family land use category, South County Inland Planning Area, County File Number 2004-00211, Tract 2643, Supervisorial District 4, Stephanie Fuse, Project Manager.
Good morning again, Chairman, members of the Commission, Stephanie Fuse, County Planning. This project is actually very similar to the previous map. This project is a subdivision of a 1.2-acre parcel into five parcels of approximately 10,000 square feet each. The project is located on the corner of Bloom and Grandy in the community of Napomo. The project is in the residential single-family land use category. The main issue that came up with the review of this project was the proximity to an existing greenhouse operation. The Ag Commissioner proposed mitigation measures for dust, pesticides, and noise. The applicant has agreed to these measures in a developer statement, and they have become conditions of approval for the project. So based on the previous discussion, we do have a few changes to make. condition 21M on page 2-7, we would be adding to be in the negative declaration also has the vernal pool as critical habitat, and that's stock language that obviously needs to be amended.
What page is that?
And that is on page 219.
So we're getting rid of the last sentence under setting, which is the project site is located within an area designated as critical habitat for the vernal pool fairy shrimp. That line is going away, and we added another word earlier.
Getting rid of vernal pool habitat and having vernal pool region.
Region.
Wait, what about, I'm sorry, but what about just, if we're going to do stock language, what about saying identified as potential vernal pool habitat?
We could do that, too.
Work for everybody else?
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm looking to my left, and I'm seeing at least one head nod yes. Okay, and I presume on page 224, we're missing the solid waste and other public facilities.
I'm going to presume that was an insignificant impact.
You know, I must have just been doing these on the same exact day. Yes.
Ah, yes. But you were waiting for another piece of information to come in before you could check that, and you just... Okay.
And with those changes, staff is recommending approval of the project based on findings in Exhibit A and the conditions as amended in Exhibit B, and that the commission adopt the negative declaration for the project.
Could you discuss this fencing to be removed from the nursery property? What's that all about? It's noted on 241, replace fencing if removed from nursery property. Now, how can this applicant go to somebody else's property and mess with their fence?
I think it goes to if the road has to be widened, if the widening happens to take out the chain link fencing that exists for the greenhouse operation, that they would be required to replace that fencing for the greenhouse operation.
So the fence is now in the right-of-way?
Potentially. I don't know that that's been determined through the survey yet.
Mr. Goodwin, do you have weigh in on that?
Mike Goodwin, Public Works. According to the tentative map on page 250, the fence goes right down the center of the right-of-way. So although it's on the, or if it's a little off-center and on the greenhouse property, it's still in the right-of-way, and it would be on the greenhouse's property, but anyone in the subdivision would have the right to develop that road. So they would move the fence to the edge of the right-of-way to enable them to develop the street.
So it would be still on the right-of-way property. We wouldn't have to trespass on someone else's land.
That's correct.
Thank you. Further questions for staff?
Yes, I have a question about the part of the ag buffering is a block wall to be constructed. On 2-8, condition 21M, speaks to a 4 to 6 foot solid block wall. And on 231, in the, I believe it's the letter from the Ag Commissioner, no, it's actually the mitigation summary table, number 3 on 231 indicates that they shall construct a solid block wall 8 feet in height between Bloom Street and future residences. I have some fundamental questions about the design of this project as it relates to buffering from the ag buildings. And I'll pick that up after public testimony. But let me point out that discrepancy right now and see how that might be resolved.
Actually, the 8-foot block wall that's on number 3 of the mitigation summary table was negotiated with the applicant and ag commissioner's office to 4 to 6 feet. And that's... the developer statement that was signed has 4 to 6 feet, and the condition was pulled forward accordingly.
So that was a negotiation between whom?
The Ag Department, the applicant, and planning staff.
Okay.
I'm gonna raise that as, again when we get to discussion. That whole concept concerns me some, but for now, that answers my question.
Further questions?
The only other question I have, and I think I noticed on the agency review that this particular project wasn't reviewed by APCD. And I know it isn't our responsibility that they respond to us, but just a little, because we sort of have their standard stock letter, stop, you're doing the wrong thing.
Generally, we do refer tracts to the Air Pollution Control District, and sometimes we receive a response and sometimes we don't.
Oh, okay.
Not even their normal dust?
With other land uses. It states that the only potential inconsistency was previously discussed in the Ag Resources section of this document relating to the existing greenhouse operation. So I think we missed the discussion about the impacts of this project to the adjacent agricultural operations. So maybe we need to have that discussion.
I think even just the finding, if you read above the no mitigations measures, the project is located in a predominantly non-ag area with no commercial ag operations in the immediate vicinity. I think that's just the wrong stock sentence because
right. The
aerial photo suggests otherwise. And other discussions, actually, in the staff report as well.
Okay, I have another one for Mr. Goodwin. His referral on page 237. You're talking about the individual draining basins are at the high point on the lot. How will they work? Did you ever get that answered?
I have not received an answer, but it would be part of the condition. There's a condition that they have drainage plan and review, and
maybe
we have no problem with them moving the basins around. But
maybe the applicant can discuss that when it's his turn then, because I'm kind of curious how that's going to get the water to go uphill.
And actually, the ag buffer is 150 feet from the ag operation, so I think that the basins are actually going to have to be moved to a different location on the site to accommodate that buffer. So where they're proposed on the tentative map, when the final map gets reviewed, I don't believe they'll be in that same location.
Okay, then are we doing this a little premature then? If we don't know where everything's going to be located.
Yeah, I have similar questions, and it relates to the design of where access is taken and where the buffer is located and a number of other things.
Ms. Griffin had
it. Very rarely know where everything will be located. The drainage calculations are what is reviewed by Public Works, and they determine where and how deep and how many drainage basins are necessary when those drainage calculations are submitted as part of the final map. It may end up that they only need two of the four drainage basins or one deep one in a different location, and that's all done with a substantial conformity call at the time of recordation.
Those have not always been... I won't go there. Further questions for staff? The applicant, I'll move on to the public hearing and ask the applicant to step up and make a few statements and answer a few questions.
Oh, okay, I'll do that. Terry Orton, Westland Engineering. I got about three or four things that I've got on my list. First off, this site is a sloping site and is not lend itself to habitat for fairy shrimp. I've been involved with projects that have had fairy shrimp and also vernal pools on them, and this definitely does not. This particular area in Napomo does not, as a matter of fact, for the other projects also. If you'll notice on the map, the tentative map that was in, I'm addressing drainage a little bit now, you'll notice that there's a grading that's shown. And by the way, those ponds no longer end up on the high spot. They end up in the back of the lot. Well, we're probably going to have to move them to the front in order to accommodate the setbacks that have been established. But that was why they were in back. We actually were grading the lots so that they would be flat pads with ponds in the backyard. But now we're probably going to have to, unfortunately, move them to the front based on the setbacks for the agricultural operations. The negotiation regarding the height of the wall, this one's specific. What we did, we've had a lot of problems with heights of walls in Napomo. I don't know if all of you have been on with the discussions that have occurred. So we came up with what we thought was a good idea, and it was agreed on by the ag people. We're putting the wall at the top of a bank. So our effective height is still 8 feet if it were to be at the property line, but by moving it to the top of a bank, we're able to make it 4 feet high, and that way we do a bunch of different things. This is some of the issues we've been dealing with the NCAC over the years regarding heights of wall and things like that. This addresses that particular issue. It also moves the wall away from the, that right next to the back a walk sort of thing that we so frequently see in different places, and it softens the projects that way. So we thought it was a really good negotiated stance, but in reality we're meeting the intent of what they did by just moving the wall itself is what it amounted to. Respond to them.
I have a question. Have you worked on any other projects, or this is perhaps my learning experience, in which the detention retention basins can be located within the buffer zone?
Yes.
So that is something that we could do?
Oh, yes. That's perfectly acceptable, right.
Has your experience been a positive one as you've seen these projects develop?
Well, with respect to the detention, what we're referring to, the reason we tend to put them in the backyard is because we can get a larger area to do it. And so what we do is we just make a depressed area for playing and that sort of thing. By putting them in the front, we have to compete with the driveway.
Yeah, no, my question really was, do they in any way, are they in any way detrimental to the buffer zone? I mean, to me, they both seem compatible with each other. That's my question.
No, they're compatible. There's nothing that is, that one influences the other sort of thing. So they're compatible uses, yes.
Then I guess I would have to ask the question of why we have a discussion that you would have to move these to the front.
It basically, the configuration becomes a little more difficult, is all. But
the configuration of what?
The basin.
If it were left where it's shown today, mm-hmm. in the rear, mm-hmm. which is also the buffered area.
No. It's the other way around. No. The front's the buffered area. The
greenhouse. Okay.
Okay. I see where you're going. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I was a little confused.
I wasn't following the discussion.
Greenhouse is here.
Mm-hmm.
But you want it north at the top of the page, like I did. I know.
Yes. picky.
Oh, and just one other, just small item too. I've on two other projects. I've already moved that chain link fence back to the right of way. So this is going to be consistent with what we've done next door.
I'd just like to confirm, going back to this wall, it's peculiar to Parcel 4 because of the configuration of the proposed subdivision to mitigate dust and noise, as I understand. I can't put my finger on it, but that's part of the ag buffering solution, which is basically dust and noise from the ag operation.
My experience, just particularly with this particular greenhouse, the noise issues on this particular greenhouse are... They're coolers on the other side. So I'm not thinking we're going to get much in the way of a noise issue on this side. The next issue comes that you're referring to is dust. This is truly a greenhouse. The growing is done inside. Mm-hmm. So we won't have a dust issue. I believe the actual issue is one of pesticides and that sort of thing. And I suspect that's why the setback is in this particular area, and they're trying to get the actual airflow to actually go higher than.
I don't see any indication of that as the impact to be mitigated in here. I can't find what I thought was the impact either. So
well, what just from my discussions in the past and working with the greenhouses, traditionally greenhouses have a smaller setback than, let's say, other types, and it is because they don't generate as much of the items that you're referring to. Yes. Right.
But, again, this wall is peculiar to 4 because of the layout of the project. It doesn't extend across 3, 2, 1, any of the other ones.
Right. Okay. That's correct.
I didn't have any questions until you just brought up the issue of pesticides. And so I'm curious as to, since you say you have worked with greenhouses in the past, how do greenhouses disperse? I'm assuming that the pesticide use is within the greenhouse.
That's one of the nice things about greenhouses is because, and I've had a lot of operators mention this to me, is when they go to put their pesticide in or whatever they are, they close all the flaps. They get some of the best uses on their best, I hate to use the term kills or whatever you want to use, but
that's
they get some of the best quality out of it. And the thing is, the pesticides they're using have a very short life because they've got to get people back into that greenhouse as shortly as possible. So what happens is they close off the greenhouse, they put in their pesticides, and then when their actual shelf life or
actually, Mr. Nelson.
Reentry period.
Yeah, thank you. Is over, then they can open it, and then their personnel can go inside also.
So they don't vent the greenhouses per se. It's not a situation where we would have vents in the top of the greenhouses that would be dispersing pesticides to the adjacent residences?
They have vents in the top. There are two sentences here. They have vents in the top, but generally when they do their pesticide, they close them off. The only
Morning, my name is Brian Deal. I live at 714 Citrus Lane, which is probably about 100 feet away from this development. My primary concern with this is access, and I haven't seen how Bloom Street is addressed in that. I have small kids riding bicycles, skateboards, and stuff in the area, and I don't really want to see Bloom Street go through as the increased traffic would propose safety hazard to my kids. A couple other points that I noticed. Noise is an issue. I live probably 75 feet away from that same greenhouse that's just a little bit farther south. 7 o'clock Saturday morning, they are swinging hammers and nailing down plastic in that area. So the taller wall you can get, the better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else from the public? The applicant would like to make any concluding remarks? You should stay up in the front. You know this is going to happen. I got commissioners that got to go to the bathroom.
Just the conditions of approval are we have to put Bloom Street through for circulation. This has been a big issue in the Napomo area of circulation, and this is one of the streets that they have shown for going as a through street.
Thank you. Let's close the public hearing, bring it back to the commission for discussion and action.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I indicated earlier, I have several concerns with the design of this subdivision.
Well, if we're going to have several concerns, at least one commissioner got to go to the bathroom here. So let's take a break. Come back here at 10:30.
Okay.
Well, she was wiggling a lot. I know what that means.